Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sudden drop in President Obama's approval rating to an all-time low that is apparently due to the high price of gas. The nation's leading expert on oil and gas markets, Fidel Geit, joins us to explain how Wall Street speculation accounts for 30% of the price at the pump. He is a senior vice president for oil and gas at Oppenheimer & Company and has testified many times to the Senate and the House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Then joining us in the studio is Sean Parnell, the author of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. He served with the 10th Mountain Division for 6 years and retired as a captain, having served on the Pakistani-Afghan border, where his platoon suffered the highest casualty rate since Gettysburg, with over 80% casualties. We'll get a soldier's perspective on the war in Afghanistan, which, following the recent massacre of civilians, may end sooner with an accelerated U.S. withdrawal. Then finally, we'll speak with Elizabeth Holtzman, the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. She is the co-author of Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law, Plotted to Avoid Prosecution, and What We Can Do About It. We will discuss why we can't move on and how the failure to take action against a former president who has committed crimes stands as an indictment of the society that permits the impunity. And joining us now is Fidel Geit, who's a senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Geit has a degree in chemical engineering and more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research. He's previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York, and he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fidel Geit.
Thank you.
And what explains the high price of gasoline, particularly as now a CBS poll has revealed that the president's approval ratings dropped precipitously from over 50% down to 41%, apparently because of the perception that he should be doing something about the price of oil?
Well, it's so unfortunate that we penalize this president or any other president for the price of gas. President have no magic wand that bring down crude oil prices. And the reason I say that, because the price that we pay at the pump, 75% or more, is directly related to crude oil prices. So if we want to see gasoline prices at the pump lower, we should hope for lower, much lower oil prices. But again, it's a commodity that the price is set by global events. We have very little to do with oil prices. We can do our part, but we do not account for a significant volume of production. We are the largest consumer of oil in the world, but unfortunately, we import half of what we consume. So therefore, we have to pay what the going rate in the marketplace. And the going rate in the marketplace suggests that oil prices at the pump are really not as expensive as many people think, since people in Europe and in Asia, in Japan, pay a lot more than what we pay here.
But my understanding is, and I believe OPEC has verified this, that global demand is down, local demand is down, supply is up, the U.S. is exporting more gasoline than ever. So there's got to be another explanation for
we all know that speculation is part and parcel of the commodity price, especially of oil prices. I do believe that oil prices are inflated by at least 30%. I don't think that the global economy can sustain or can justify the current oil prices. And for people to understand, the global commodity is really not our benchmark price. Our benchmark price is $6 right now, but the global commodity index is 126, which is Brent crude. So the product is priced on the global index, which is Brent, which is $126 per barrel. So right off the bat, more than 75% of what we pay at the pump is directly correlated to Brent crude oil price. So speculation is here to stay because the financial lobby is very strong, much more powerful than any administration, whether Republican or Democrat. And unless or until the federal government clamp down on speculation, we will be paying higher than we should at the pump. And unfortunately, we can't blame the president. We just blame dysfunctional Washington for not being able to come to an agreement that excessive speculation is not in our best interest.
Again, I'm speaking with Fidel Guyot, Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. He's also previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Chase and is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. But what about the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission? That is their job, to oversee speculation. And my understanding that they were paralyzed for a long time because of Commissioner Dunn, appointed by the Bush administration, although he's supposedly a Democrat. He's now, I believe, lobbying for the lobby of speculators, if you will. They apparently sued the CTFC, who was trying to bring about position limits. If you have a market where, my understanding is, between 80 and 90% of the future contracts are being bought by hedge funds and pension funds, etc., and not by end users like oil refineries and airlines, isn't that completely distorting the whole intention of the commodities market?
Absolutely. But again, this is some of the recommendation that I suggested to Congress, and that was 4 years ago. And I was not the only one, and I was not the first, and I'm not going to be the last. Everybody can see it, and everybody knows it. But the question is, can we fix it? And unless there is a will, unless the public would rally behind the administration and push for reform, nothing is going to get done. And the same people that brought about the 2008 financial meltdown and bailouts that cost taxpayers billions of dollars, they are doing the same thing again. And the public cannot do anything about it because the politician holding the key. Nothing the CFTC can do without approval of Congress. They can suggest as much as they want. They can do whatever they want. But at the end of the day, the financial lobby is too strong to pass any limitation on these people. They make billions of dollars. Unfortunately, the money they make is coming out of my pocket and your pocket and everybody who buys gasoline in this country, subsidizing these people who make millions or billions every year in profit at the expense of the taxpayer.
Well, what then explains, Fidel Guyot, why does the press not report what we're talking about? Why do they keep referring to these ridiculous excuses like OPEC and a possible war with Iran and every other thing about, except what's really driving up the price of oil?
Absolutely. I truly believe that putting a position limit will immediately take gasoline prices at least by 20%.
Well, apart from Senator Bernie Sanders, I don't see anybody even talking about it. You know, that's the surprising part. It's like the 900-pound gorilla sitting in the living room.
Well, it's unfortunate because I don't know what else do we need to prove the point and how many financial meltdown and collapse can the economy, go through without very dramatic changes in the way we do business. Financial institutions are still getting away with a lot. And until or unless limits are imposed by Congress, I don't think this is going to get us anywhere.
Well, it's not as if we haven't seen this movie before, Fidel Guyot. Remember back in 2008 when oil was at $147 a barrel, CBS did a report an investigation. They found that most of the oil wasn't owned by Exxon or Mobil or all the big companies, but in fact it was owned by J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs.
Exactly. Actually, the top 10 financial institutions that are involved in the trading of the commodity account for about 80% of the volume. The commercial customer, the real companies that use oil to make for goods and service and everything else, account for the remaining 20%. Exxon has very little to do. Exxon does not hedge at all. Other companies hedge, but not at a significantly higher than what they produce. But the financial institution, they do not use the commodity. It's paper chase. It's basically an electronic screen that are moving markets up and down. And this market, in my view, or this activity should be stopped. And part of me wish that gas prices will hit an all-time high, so people finally wake up and say enough is enough, and push that their congressman would vote, for legislation that will limit or eliminate this financial dealing by the commodity traders. So unless or until that happens, I don't think we'll see any meaningful change.
But my understanding, Fidel Guide, is that they make money as it goes up, and that's why it's being driven up all the time. But at some point or other, it crashes, doesn't it? That happened back in 2008.
Unfortunately, again, what we've seen, these financial institutions are willing to take huge risk, and then they're too big to fail because the government will always come and bail them out, because basically they are holding government hostages. Look what happened in Europe, look what happened in the U.S. And unfortunately, the taxpayer is footing this bill. So the financial institutions are only good in making profit and doling out very fat bonuses, but when things really go out of control, they go and cry to their government to bail them out, because they say, if you don't, the whole economy will collapse. So this is like a suicide bombing, if you will, and taking everybody with them. So this has to change, and I don't know what other financial collapse we need in order for us finally to recognize that the days of excesses are over, and we really have to change things for good.
So Fidel Guide, again, Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company, and previously was with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company, and you testified on a number of occasions to the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. The conversation we're having, I wish the President would have this conversation with the American people. Do you think it would be effective if he did?
Absolutely. I think he should educate the American public. Unfortunately, the American people are listening to politicians that are totally irresponsible. They make an outrageous statement. Newt Gingrich is saying that if you vote for him, he will bring gas prices to $2.50. I can tell you, I've been in this business 30 years, and I could not think of how can he possibly do that unless he brings oil prices down by $60 or $70. And obviously, that can only happen in one scenario. If we have a global depression, then oil prices can go as low as Newt Gingrich wants. But $2.50 when you have $100+ oil, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I suppose in a way it's too convenient to be able to blame it all on OPEC and the Saudis and others, right?
OPEC has nothing to do with it, and the Saudis have nothing to do with it. The markets are set by several forces. One of them, unfortunately, is financial speculation. And financial speculation, started 10 or 15 years ago, but now it is really driving the market. In the past, it used to be trailing, now it is leading by far. It's not OPEC anymore. It is not the oil companies anymore. It is basically financial speculators, and these people are in control of this market and have been for quite a long time, and unfortunately is not going to change unless we have legislation to really, really clip their wings and make them as what they should do, facilitate trade, not to be part of the trade, not to have equity position, not to commingle with your clients' money like we have the debacle, the $1.5 billion debacle that the trading IMF Global whatever went through, disappearing $1.5 billion. And again, nothing is going to happen. You know, no criminal, no smoking gun, nothing. We've been in this movie before. We've heard it before. And again, we didn't learn from the lesson, and that will repeat itself. And we're going to have more and more and more of these cases.
Well, of course, MF Global, the head of that, was the former head of Goldman Sachs. I guess that's the they're the princes, right? The princes of Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, these people, they pay hundreds of millions of dollars in fine without admitting any guilt. I want to see who would want to do that. Why would I pay so hundreds of millions of dollars if I did nothing wrong? So obviously, we know what it's all about. One can rob a bank and then pay a small penalty, but keep on robbing the bank. And as long as they can get away with it, they will do it over and over again. So financial speculation is not healthy for this country. It's not good for consumer. It's not good for anybody. It only helps one group of people, the less than 1%. These are the guys who are benefiting significantly from basically gouging consumer, basically for inflating prices. And as long as I said, as long as they are getting away with it, they are not going to stop. They are not going to feel sorry for doing what they are doing. They think it's they're smart. They think it's legal. Obviously the government allowed them to do that for the lack of ability to curtail their activity.
Well, as you said, Fidel Guide, the Congress could force the CTFC to bring in position limits and to make the market about what it should be to hedge and protect the real customers for oil, which are the oil refineries and the bulk buyers like the airline companies. But as we know, the Congress is in the hands at this moment of a very pro-Wall Street clique led by Eric Cantor, who's promised the speculators that if they take over in the Senate, they'll be able to make even more money.
But at the end of the day, obviously it is easy to use misinformation in a presidential election year, but really the Republican are really not addressing the issues, and it's like mudslinging contest. But nobody really has any solution for anything. You know, if they can't find any answer, they blame the president or blame somebody else. But they really do not have any plan or agenda, or just faulting what's happening without finding a solution for it. So, but I'd be very curious to see, you know, what the Republican challengers have in terms of solution to the high gasoline prices, and want them to explain how you're going to get. I want to know how Newt Gingrich can get us to buy gasoline at $2.50 instead of $4.50. I love to hear that.
Well, Fidel Guide, I thank you so much for filling our audience in on what's really behind the high price of gasoline. It's refreshing to hear and very infuriating that the rest of the press don't want to tell the public about what's really happening.
And we haven't even started the summer driving season yet. And with the nice weather we have, I can guarantee you the gas prices have one way to go, and that's up.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Fidel Guide.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guide, who's a Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York. Mr. Guide, who has a degree in chemical engineering, has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research. He has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a veteran of the Afghan War. Fill up my truck on the way to work. Those gas prices.
prices really hurt. It's like feeding the hungry beast with liquid gold. One day I'll look up and there'll be $10 a gallon staring back at me. You know the price of gas is getting out of control. Put $100 in my tank. I'm a working man, don't own a bank.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sean Parnell, a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who served in the 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain. He received 2 Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart and is the author, with John Bruning, of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Parnell.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And clearly we're at a time now where you feel like, I think it's been going on for some time, that the Americans or NATO and the Afghans have had a very star-crossed relationship, shall we say. But now it's reached a sort of untenable point, it seems, where the American soldiers who are making the sacrifice there, and the American taxpayer, of course, is making sacrifice, are wondering what they're getting for what they put in. And on the other hand, you get the impression that the Afghans more and more are starting to see the Americans and NATO not so much as liberators, but as occupiers who've overstayed their welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable to conclude that right now. I do think that it's moving in that direction. If we aren't there already.
When you first went in, it seems like in the first engagement that you're expecting a kind of ragtag bunch of irregulars, but you got a real wake-up call, right?
Yeah, so tell
us about that.
Well, I mean, when we went to Afghanistan, the eyes of the nation, the American political apparatus and the military brass was wholeheartedly focused on Iraq and the growing insurgency there. What are we going to do about Iraq? And so we did the best we could training in garrison to prepare for an eventual combat deployment to Afghanistan, but we didn't know. We couldn't even glean intelligence from our own military brass on what it would actually be like because nobody cared. So when we got there, we thought, you know, let's just say we weren't facing farmers with pitchforks. These guys were seasoned and hardened light infantry that had been fighting literally for the better part of 30 years.
Wow. It feels like it was always an orphan project. Did you ever feel like that you guys were getting shortchanged and the real focus was on Iraq?
So get this. When we got to Afghanistan, we were bolting our own armor on our Humvees. We had pickup truck Humvees that the Army didn't even use anymore. We had the only up armored Humvee that we had at the time was used in Bosnia.
Oh, wow.
So that was what we had to work with initially. I mean, it got better. It got better when people realized that Afghanistan, I think, in 2006 was really spiraling out of control. And that's when I think people really started to take notice. It got better. But that's what we were dealing with initially.
But one of the things that's so ironic about it is that the initial takedown of the Taliban was done with only about 800 soldiers, or something unbelievable.
Yeah.
Done very effectively. And my understanding is that the Afghan people really thought the Americans were the liberators, and that they thought, wow, you know, you're the guys that put somebody on the moon. You're going to fix this place, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And it didn't happen.
No, yeah. And I think you're talking about the difference in strategy. And I've been very critical of the strategy that's being implemented in Afghanistan right now. But what we're talking about back in 2001, 2002, 2003, we had a counter-terror strategy where we were relying heavily on special operations units to do the fighting in Afghanistan, supported with air, and it was pretty effective. I mean, we took down the Taliban in just a short few months, and Afghanistan seemed like it was moving in the right direction. And then all of a sudden, there was this sudden shift around 2003 to this nation-building counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan that's just not going to work.
And when did you come into Afghanistan?
2006, January 2006.
So this strategy was already 3 years on, and
I remember talking to David Kilcullen, who's one of the guys that was behind the surge, Petraeus's advisor, and he came up with this notion of the armed social worker.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like you guys were doing a lot of social work.
No. So the idea of like therapeutic social workers out of the window when people are shooting at you, you know, that's the first, you realize that yeah, you're not a social worker when people are shooting at you. But yeah, I mean, we didn't do a whole lot of that. I mean, the idea of counterinsurgency operations was really in its infancy when we were there. This was our idea of counterinsurgency. We were focused on going out and finding the enemy and rooting them out in this lawless, mountainous border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But that was only one part of our mission. Like, we accomplished the counterinsurgency, but we accomplished that part of the mission by making every mission simultaneously a humanitarian one as well. We packed, along with our ammunition, we packed coloring books for kids, food, water, you know, clothes for the locals, and every patrol that we went on was simultaneously a humanitarian patrol, and it worked extraordinarily well. I mean, we wreaked devastating effects on our enemy there, and we never, ever once killed one civilian, ever, the entire time there.
But you were also, and when you were there, you know, you were the unit, your platoon took 80% casualties, the highest since Gettysburg, right there on the Afghan-Pakistan border. In a way, you were right there in the middle of all of the problems that the U.S. have had since 2001,
mm-hmm.
the duplicity of the Pakistanis and the corruption of the leadership. Let's start with the duplicity of the Pakistanis. That's something, you're looking at Pakistan every day, right?
Yep, every single day. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the bad guys are coming from, right?
Yeah.
And the guys that you occasionally liaison with, the Pakistani guards, or the Frontier Corps, I guess mm-hmm. they're called, you know, you liaise with them, but you know they're working for the other guys, right?
Yeah. So the Frontier Corps, here's some context of the Frontier Corps. When the Brits were occupying Pakistan, they had a model called the Northwest Frontier Corps, where they had one British officer, several active duty pack mill soldiers on the border, and they would man border checkpoints. So when the Brits left and Pakistan took over their own country, they kept that same model and called it the Frontier Corps on the border. They had one active duty pack mill officer with several ragtag militia from local villages around the area that didn't recognize the border at all. So that right there is the problem with the border. Is the fact that the people that are manning the Frontier Corps and these border checkpoints, they don't recognize the Durand Line, which is basically a pencil scratch on a map to the locals.
But I understand from your book again, Sean Parnell, Outlaw Platoon: Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan, that the pack mill, as you call them, were much, much closer to both the insurgents and to the Haqqani network.
Yes. Yeah. So we give Pakistan, I think, roughly $6 billion a year in humanitarian and military assistance. And what we saw when we were there is that they were treating our enemy in their hospitals, giving their antibiotics to heal, and then sending them back on the battlefield. And then there were some instances where our enemy was using pack mill checkpoints to fire at us from those checkpoints, effectively using the pack mill as human shield, knowing that we couldn't shoot back at them without causing an international incident. And then the pack mill Frontier Corps came to attack us directly on several occasions, and it was never reported on the news back here even once. And that's one of the major themes, sort of ancillary themes that I talk about in Outlaw Platoon, is that we have this idea in this country that the Pakistan is our erstwhile ally, both strategically and on the ground, and that is just not the case.
So what do you think their end game is? Because this incident that just took place with the U.S. soldier massacred their civilians, 9 kids sleeping in their beds, that's clearly having a detrimental effect, and a lot of analysts say it's going to accelerate the withdrawal.
Yep.
What do you see as the Pakistan end game?
Well, I think this is a really there's a real complex geopolitical situation surrounding Pakistan, and I think they benefit. The government, the central government of Pakistan, benefits greatly from a weak Afghanistan. And I think their conflict and sworn conflict with India is the reason why they benefit. And I think what they want at a strategic level is to use Afghanistan as a buffer should there be a conflict with India. I think that's reason number one for their keeping Afghanistan unstable. And it's very complicated for us too, because Pakistan is a nuclear power. And our worst fear is that somehow, like a tactical nuclear weapon, will find their find its way into the hands of a terrorist. And I think that's...
Right. Well, so it's not out of the question, given that Pakistan is the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal on the planet.
Yep.
They've just surpassed the French in the numbers of warheads they have, and they're apparently equal now to the Brits, at least as far as we know. They claim to have a very professional command and control over their nuclear weapons. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what did we learn from the takedown of Osama bin Laden right next to their military academy? It's one of three possibilities. One, that the ISI and the top military knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, somebody down the chain of command knew about it, lower down in the ranks of ISI, etc. Or three, none of the above knew about it. Now,
yeah.
Number three is almost too ridiculous to even contemplate. So if you take number two, then you don't have any confidence that they have real good command and control. And that seems to be their excuse, that maybe some people down the chain knew about it, but not us guys at the top.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on it?
First of all, I'm really impressed with how well informed you are in your use of the military lingo. I'm impressed. But to your point, I think if I were a betting man, which I'm not, but if I was, I would put money on mid-level Paki ISI knowing exactly where he was and not acting on it. I mean, I'd put money on it that they knew.
So how does the rank and file then feel, given that you guys are putting in life on the line and you had the highest casualties, your platoon, mm-hmm. 80%, the highest since Gettysburg, how do you keep your morale up when you know the guys that you can see across the way there are shooting you in the back, so as to speak, and you know that your partners are... Well, let's talk about your partners. We talked about Pakistan's duplicity. Walk us through some of your experiences in terms of Afghanistan's corruption, and, we're doing nation building with Karzai, and nobody's ever suggested that this guy was Afghanistan's Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, no, there's corruption at literally every level of their government. So this idea that we can somehow prop up a Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan is just ludicrous to me. Our experience with the Afghan National Army initially was not good. They got better because we had, as time wore on, we embedded U.S. Marines with them to train them, so they got better. But most of the time, we were the ones fighting and bleeding for their country while the Afghan National Army played soccer or smoked hash. And it's, to your point and question about morale, our morale stayed up because of how we relied on one another and our love for one another. We focused on what mattered most to us, and that was faith in each other. And I made sure, like when I wrote the book, to capture the human element of war, which is so often lost. I think all the best soldiers are humanists. And what's funny is that like people scoff, especially on the left, at the idea of a humanistic sort of soldier. But
right. Well,
I think
it sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah. It does. People laugh at it. But I think the best soldiers are humanists. And what I wanted to do when I wrote this book was show the world, and specifically American society, how wonderfully diverse my platoon was and how that was their greatest strength, was their diversity.
But on the other hand, the guys that are coming at you from day one, from mm-hmm. your first encounter, they're obviously highly motivated. I mean, I don't know whether you saw the documentary Restrepo.
I did. Mm-hmm. That was one of the units that I trained. They came right after us.
And that was in the same Corrigan Valley, right?
We were south. The Brumell Valley was south, but that unit came right after us.
Right. But in that particular firebase that they had, they were coming at, about an 80-degree angle or something,
yeah.
attacking at an 80-degree angle. It's unheard of.
Yeah.
Since, maybe Gallipoli or something.
No. This happens in Afghanistan. This is a regular occurrence. On June 10th, 2006, we were almost overrun by an enemy that outnumbered us 5-1. They were charging up unbelievable angles and mountains to get to us. They were running through sheets of artillery that we were calling on. They were actually trying to get closer to us so that we couldn't fire artillery at them anymore. And, I was about to give the command fix bayonets, and I realized that we don't carry bayonets anymore. So what do you do? But these fighters, our enemy in Afghanistan, has absolutely no fear, and they are highly motivated.
And what did you guys, first of all, it's got to be scary as hell.
It is.
And two, what did you finally conclude about their motivation? They're fighting for their land?
Yeah, I don't know. I think most of the fighters that we were fighting weren't even from Afghanistan.
They weren't. They were the
foreign fighters, and I mean, so in
so our, they're these are the guys that are indoctrinated on the other side and come over.
Yeah.
You weren't actually fighting Afghans then.
For the most part, no. For the most part, no. I mean, the enemy that we were facing in our area of operations was not a monolithic force at all. I mean, we saw Haqqani Network, we saw Taliban, and we saw Al-Qaeda foreign fighters, all of which we faced in one way, shape, or form. And what we saw as the deployment wore on was the Haqqani Network formed this loose partnership with the Taliban because their goals are different. They don't really like each other, but they joined forces to fight us. And what we saw after they joined forces was that they would coalesce around these tough Al-Qaeda foreign fighters who had been fighting jihad all around the globe all their lives, who then trained them as their sort of rudimentary command and control. And that's when things got really difficult for us.
And so given the recent events that I think combined with the Quran burning and this recent massacre, you can tell that even the Republican opponents of President Obama are now saying we should get out.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American people in general are probably pretty tired of this whole thing.
I think they are too.
So what's your sense of how the chips are going to fall here? We got till 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of an Afghan army is going to be standing up in 2014?
Well, I don't think the Afghan army is ready. I think that they've got courageous fighters and infantrymen, boots on the ground soldiers that are willing to fight and die for their country, which is great. But in order to have an army, you have to be able to move them, feed them, give them water, supply them, and pay them. And the Afghan government is not capable of that. And until you meet those criteria that I just mentioned, you don't have an army, and they don't have one. We still pay them.
Right.
So,
and by the way, the Wall Street Journal reported that in 2011, $5 billion in cash went out of Kabul airport to the Gulf. So you get the feeling that the elite have been living off this war, profiting from it, and they've already got one foot out of the country already, and mm-hmm. their money's parked in Dubai.
Yeah, I think that. So, to your question of where do we go from here,
right.
I think that, first of all, the Quran burnings, terrible mistake. And I think that this massacre of these civilians at the hand of this rogue soldier was the worst thing that could have happened in the wake of these Quran burnings. And I understand people's anger and frustration and the fact that they're horrified at the loss of life. But I think we really should resist running for the door just yet. I think now we have a unique opportunity to take a look at our strategy and change directions. But here's the most important point. American interests decide in Afghanistan. Thousands of civilian Afghans will die if we pull out.
Uh-huh.
And
you mean in a renewed civil war?
In a renewed civil war, and those Afghans that were those thousands of Afghans that have supported us in our time there will die.
But is there anything that we can do? I mean, to prevent that. I mean, what is a workable strategy? Because I understand that there's Biden's been fighting against counterinsurgency,
mm-hmm.
as you have suggested. It was a forced strategy starting in 2003, right?
Yep.
He's been against it and tried to argue in favor of counterterrorism.
Yes.
And Petraeus pretty much won that argument, but now he's at the CIA, so I guess there's a vacuum there. What's the alternative strategy then? How could you have a workable counterterrorism strategy with few boots on the ground?
Well, I think, we accomplished great things with the counterterrorist strategy in 2001 through 2003. I think we need to go back to that model, first of all. But I also think that we need to start putting more pressure on Hamid Karzai to try to unify Afghans under a common banner. And Massoud was actually able to do that until he was killed just prior to 9/11. People in Afghanistan, all around the country, regardless of province, they still carry pictures of the guy around in their wallet. So he was able to do it. And
right.
I think we need to see and take a look at how he was able to affect the hearts and minds of so many Afghans. And I think we need to try to put more pressure on Karzai to do that, to get there.
But we've been doing that forever. Putting pressure on him. And I mean, my understanding is that the secret talks that are going on now in Dubai, the Afghans aren't even in these talks. It's largely the Taliban, and very opaque, not much is known about it, but the U.S. is supposedly meeting secretly with the Taliban. I imagine it would be the Pakistanis must be brokering it. There's no way in the world they're not going to, be a part of this.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to understand
what the negotiations. Do you think that there would ever be a way that the Taliban, and particularly the guys that you're fighting, which are even the more extreme guys, right, the Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani, they don't know how to do anything else, right? So if you're going to have with a weak government there, what would be the counter-terrorism strategy to contain them so that we don't go back to what we had before 9/11?
Well, I think just our presence there with regards to it. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. I think just our presence there will deter these foreign fighters enough so that we don't go back to a pre-9/11 era in Afghanistan. But if we pulled out of Afghanistan tomorrow, and, you know, I just told you that I think thousands of Afghans will die if that happens. But that aside, if we pull out of Afghanistan tomorrow, it will fall right back to where it was in 2 months prior to us being there. September 11th. I mean, I think you'd see the Haqqani network and Haig and Hekmati, our soldiers, foot soldiers, take control of the border. And I think you'd see the Taliban back in central Afghanistan. And
would there be any way to revive the Northern Alliance so that they wouldn't take over the entire country?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean by I think that comment is nested under what Hamid Karzai needs to do. And I think that he needs to sort of reinvigorate the Northern Alliance to start taking some risks, you know? And I think that's it. I mean, the path to liberty is fraught with peril. And I think that Hamid Karzai, the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, you know, in conjunction with the Northern Alliance, needs to start taking some risks, you know?
Well, but last time around, they got support from Russia or the mm-hmm. Soviet Union and Iran. And we know that the Pashtuns and the Taliban get support from Pakistan. So then you get into the broader issue of the geopolitics of the neighborhood, right?
Yep.
And that would mean that the U.S. would have to work. We're having trouble working with the Russians, although that's where the supplies have been coming through now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even talking to the Iranians.
Yeah, and most of the weapons when we were there at the tail end of our deployment, every weapon that we would find on the battlefield were fresh off of the Iranian factory line, RPG-9, armor-piercing RPG-9s, brand-new PKMs, RPKs, and Kalashnikov AK-47 assault rifles, all with Iranian serial numbers. Nobody was talking about that here back in the States in 2006. And so I think we're looking at an enemy force that's being fully funded by Iran.
Well, I think we've run out of time here. And there's so much more to discuss in your book, Outlaw Platoon, Sean Parnell. But I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sean Parnell. He's a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who served in the 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain. He received 2 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart and is the author, with John Bruning, of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the youngest ever U.S. congressman, in this case, congresswoman.
When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf while they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade a spade. When the president talks to God, when the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not, that voice is just inside his head?
Smoke, screams, and lies. It's not the politicians, but the actions I despise. Loose it on, should kick it like back in the day with the cocaine and Cavassier.
Would you build more bombs as you get more bold as your midlife crisis war unfolds? What you wanna do is take control of, put that access to evil bull shit on hold.
Now, citizen rule number 2080. Politicians are shady. So people watch your back because they think they smoke crack. I don't doubt it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Holtzman, the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. She won national attention for her role on the House Judiciary Committee during Watergate and was subsequently elected District Attorney of Kings County, Brooklyn. She is the co-author with Cynthia Cooper of the new book, Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law, Plotted to Avoid Prosecution, and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Holtzman.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I've been spoken to a couple of the people who were on the receiving end of Bush and Cheney's illegal torture, not to go into the illegal war itself, but to the great shame of torture, which has, of course, done terrible damage to the United States around the world. After all, we're trying to deal with a murderous thug, Assad, in Syria, and his excuse now is, well, you know, you can't accuse me of torturing my people, the Americans do it. So without getting into the litany of the damage done, Glenn Carr was a CIA officer who wrote a really interesting book called Interrogator. He was literally handed John Yoo's document as the so-called finding and sent off to do intense interrogation on the number three guy in Al-Qaeda who turned out to be a completely innocent man. I've also spoken to Ali Soufran, the FBI officer who blew the whistle on torture. So both these gentlemen have stepped forward. And frankly, in Glenn Carr's case, he hasn't got a lot of traction and a lot of respect for what he's done. How do you explain that?
Well, I'm sorry not to have been familiar with his book, but there seems to be some kind of view in the United States now that we need to have a kind of impunity for our top elected officials, even though they engaged in what I believe is at least a prima facie example of potential criminal activity. I'm a former prosecutor. I'm a lawyer. I actually taught law. I took a very close look at the statutes because I believe that there needs to be accountability when crimes, serious crimes, are committed. There are at least three criminal statutes that could apply to the conduct of Bush and Cheney. And yet, there's no discussion about what should be done. And I find that very, very troubling, because you can't, in a democracy, have a rule of law when the rule of law applies only to the weak and the unimportant and those who can't get away with it. That's not going to work. And I think it's really important for us as a nation to say we've got to have one standard of justice and one rule of law and take a look at what has been pushed in our face by Bush and Cheney. I mean, it's not as though they say we never committed the acts of torture. They acknowledge that they authorized waterboarding and approved it and were involved in it. And they acknowledge that President Bush publicly acknowledged 43 times that he acknowledged many times that he authorized illegal wiretapping 43 times. So Can we allow these actions to take place and just say, we don't care, we're just going to let them pass? I don't think we can do that. I don't exactly understand why there has been so little discussion and debate about accountability for President Bush, but that needs to happen.
Well, I also spoke recently, Elizabeth Holtman, with Tim Weiner, the New York Times investigative reporter, who's written a history of the FBI and that famous meeting that took place on Attorney General Ashcroft's bed at the hospital, where the White House counsel and the chief of staff, Andrew Card, came over and tried to get the almost comatose Attorney General to sign off on the torture regime or on the secret wiretapping regime. We don't quite know what he was they were expecting him to extend. But one of the things that Tim Weiner points out in this book that's just out now is that George W. Bush, President Bush, lied to Mueller, the FBI director. He said it's absolutely ironclad, no question about it, an automatic 5-year sentence, from my understanding. It seems like with a little digging, and I'm just reciting what I've heard recently on my radio show, it seems as though there's an awful lot out there that needs to be addressed.
Right. Well, I don't even know that you need to do any digging. I'm just talking about what we call in the law a prima facie case on the surface of it. There are three statutes that apply to what we know in public right now about what President Bush and Vice President Cheney did. Number one, there's an anti-torture statute. That says that you cannot engage in torture, and it's a U.S. felony. It's a federal crime. And they themselves have both admitted that they participated in waterboarding. Waterboarding has been held to be torture under U.S. law and under foreign law, and that needs to be looked at. They can't just say, well, it's not torture. And then secondly, we know about the wiretapping. It's not secret. The president has admitted that 43 times he authorized wiretapping without a court order. Under the law at that point, it was a felony to engage in wiretapping without a court order. So why isn't someone looking at that? We don't have to do any digging. These are facts that are not disputed. And that's what's so astonishing to me. And with regard to the war, there's another federal statute, makes it a felony, to defraud the United States. In this case, it would be the U.S. Congress. This is a statute that was used in the prosecution of Watergate, the top Watergate conspirators, namely Haldeman. This is a statute that was used to prosecute the top conspirators in the Iran-Contra scandal. And it is a statute that cries out to be looked at in connection with Bush and Cheney and how they conspired to deceive and defraud the United States, namely the U.S. Congress, with regard to going to war. These are things that we don't have to do any digging about. These are things that, right on the face of it, we need to be having a special prosecutor appointed, a fair, respectable, professional person who can take a look at the statutes and take a look at the conduct and determine whether we need to go forward. At the same time, we also need to have a truth commission to get out some of the facts that could never come out necessarily in a prosecution, but that could tell the country why we went to war in Iraq, who was responsible for various kinds of things. I mean, they're doing this in Great Britain right now. They did this in Holland. Why can't we do it in the United States?
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman, the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. She is the co-author with Cynthia Cooper of a new book, Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law, Plotted to Avoid Prosecution, and What We Can Do About It. Well, in many ways, it's true there is a British inquiry underway, and Bush and Cheney have dodged that bullet. Apparently, Dick Cheney just canceled a speaking engagement in Toronto, because he was afraid of security. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. But the idea that we've never had a truth, as opposed to truth and reconciliation, in any of these matters,
right.
and equally so with Wall Street, we never had a perp walk there. Those things are very, very instructive, aren't they, for the public? I mean, you were very much a part of the Watergate hearing. That was what President Obama calls a teachable moment, wasn't it?
Right, and the reason that the Watergate time was such an important teachable moment, if we go back in history, Richard Nixon in 1972 won an election in one of the biggest landslides in the history of the United States. Then, in less than 2 years, the American people, majority of whom had voted for Richard Nixon, were prepared to say, based on the evidence that had been produced in a bipartisan way, both by the Senate, the House of Representatives, and by the special prosecutor, were prepared to say that he should be removed from office. Now, what happened? What happened was the American people said that more important than any one person, more important than any president, more important than any party, more important than any ideology, was the rule of law and the Constitution of the United States. And that's what they said then because they understood the abuses of power that were involved. That was a teachable moment. We've had no teaching as a result of the abuses of power of Bush and Cheney. We've had no teachable moment. Instead, what we've been taught as a nation is close your eyes, forget about it, and if the high and mighty and the powerful engage in what looks like criminal conduct, we just don't say a word, we forget about it, we pass on. That's a terrible message to send, and it's a shameful message to send.
Well, without belaboring it, there was an interregnum where the President of the United States was almost impeached over a trivial personal sexual dalliance.
Right, and it was not an impeachable offense because he didn't abuse the powers of his office. People still don't understand that. But the fact of the matter is that I believe Bush and Cheney, there should have been impeachment proceedings brought against Bush and Cheney, but no proceedings were brought. Still, we do have criminal law, and we do have accountability, and we do have a Congress that could authorize, or if the President of the United States could set up a truth commission. But none of that has happened, and the odd thing is that in foreign countries, particularly in Spain, there are efforts now to hold the U.S. government accountable for torture. Why should we have to rely on a foreign country to do the work that we should be doing? And aside from that, another point is that we're out of compliance with the Geneva Conventions. We signed that under Dwight Eisenhower, ratified those conventions. And yet, those conventions require us to bring to justice people who were involved in the torture, inhuman, cruel, and degrading treatment of detainees. Well, Bush has acknowledged that he was involved in that, and yet nothing's happening to him. So here we are. We ask other countries to obey international law. We ask other countries to pay attention to human rights, but we are violating our own obligations under the Geneva Conventions right now. We are also violating our obligations because under the Bush administration, the War Crimes Act, which carries out the Geneva Conventions, was totally shredded. So we don't have a law that can be that's a useful and strong law to prosecute violators. So, I mean, we're out of compliance. What does it say about the United States?
Well, I think probably the reason it didn't happen is that the President Obama decided he didn't want to deal with the past. He wanted to deal with the future. And I'm not sure that his attorney general, he's been getting some criticism lately for not having even prosecuted anybody over the massive fraud that took place that led to the 2008 near-death experience for the global economy. And as we speak, speculators are driving up the price of gasoline unimpeded. There's a lot that makes one wonder why the Justice Department is not defending the American citizen and consumer more zealously, and why the president decided to sort of turn the other cheek, if you will. Given that, what can be done? If the president and the attorney general aren't going to step up, who is? I mean, it sounds like you are.
Well, I'm stepping up for the moment, but I can't carry all the cudgels myself. The American people have to stand up. I mean, that's what happened in Watergate. It wasn't the attorney general that stood up and tried to get Watergate investigated. It was the American people who demanded that Congress act after they saw President Nixon take the law into his own hands by firing the special prosecutor and saying, you can't investigate me. So if the American people say, we want action, we do not want a double standard of law, we do not want a dual system of justice, then people will pay attention. I mean, I think just recently in the State of the Union address, President Obama announced that he was forming a brand new unit to prosecute what I call the banksters, the people responsible for getting the country and the economy in this terrible economic situation that we're in. That happened because of pressure from Occupy Wall Street, which raised the country's consciousness about this issue. So if people understood that there was still accountability that could be had, both under the criminal laws and in terms of fact-finding and truth-finding, they could demand it of the president, they could demand it of Congress.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Holtzman.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman, the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. She won national attention for a role on the House Judiciary Committee during Watergate and was subsequently elected as the District Attorney of Kings County, that's Brooklyn. She's the co-author with Cynthia Cooper of the new book, Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law, Plotted to Avoid Prosecution, and What We Can Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was